It's the Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC. Good morning, everyone, and welcome to a special edition of our 30 Issues election series. As many of you know, we've been presenting an audio history tour of many of the issues in the presidential campaign this year. Well, today and next Friday, we are re-airing some of these audio-rich history segments, starting right now with What Makes a Great Supreme Court Justice? A few weeks ago, we saw again the power that the Supreme Court has to shape American life. When Texas was denied the right to remove access to abortion for so many women, and colleges were allowed to continue voluntary diversity programs. Last year, the court told every state that it must legalize same-sex marriage. Who gets to replace Justice Scalia has such tremendous implications for so many people, and the Senate won't even vote as of now on President Obama's nominee. But in many ways, we've been here before.
President Reagan is still our president, but he should not be able to reach out from the muck of Iran Gate, reach into the muck of Watergate, and impose his reactionary vision of the Constitution on the Supreme Court.
Senator Edward Kennedy railing against President Reagan's controversial nominee, Robert Bork, as Reagan was about a year away from leaving office in 1987. So, what makes a great Supreme Court justice?
The law is not a computer. It doesn't mean it spews out answers like a computer. Humanity and human beings are involved, both as consequences and as judges. So it's hard, and it often requires the use of values and human values. So we sometimes come to different answers, but political is the wrong word to describe it.
Justice Stephen Breyer on this program in 2011, the law is not a computer. But for Chief Justice John Roberts, maybe it sort of is.
Judges and justices are servants of the law, not the other way around. Judges are like umpires. Umpires don't make the rules, they apply them. The role of an umpire and a judge is critical. They make sure everybody plays by the rules, but it is a limited role. Nobody ever went to a ball game to see the umpire. Judges have to have the humility to recognize that they operate within a system of precedent shaped by other judges equally striving to live up to the judicial oath. And judges have to have the modesty to be open in the decisional process to the considered views of their colleagues on the bench.
Chief Justice John Roberts from his confirmation hearing in 2005. How different from Chief Justice Earl Warren, who presided over a famously progressive era on the court. Here's Earl Warren in 1971.
Every man's judgment is colored by his experiences in life and the way he reacts to those experiences. You and I might have the same experiences and the conditions that he has faced in life and the interpretations he puts upon those things, it seems to me. And all those things go into the formation of opinions. I don't see how you can help it. I've heard some judges who say that they just put the law here and the Constitution here and whichever. If the law conforms to the Constitution as they read it there, that it's good, and if it doesn't, it's bad. Mm-hmm. That's a lot of malarkey. Mm-hmm. You know, it can't be that simple. It just can't be that simple in 999 out of 1,000 cases.
Former Chief Justice Earl Warren in 1971. Now, if the current battle lines, the difference between Roberts and Breyer, the difference between Roberts and Earl Warren, feel locked in, well, they've been so for longer than you might even guess. As far back as the 1930s, President Franklin Roosevelt was frustrated with a Supreme Court majority that was skeptical of the constitutionality of some of his New Deal programs. He was so frustrated with the old, entrenched conservative justices that he proposed expanding the court to more than 9 members, up to as many as 15, being able to add an additional one each time a sitting justice turned 70 years old.
That plan has 2 chief purposes. By bringing into the judicial system a steady and continuing stream of new and younger blood, I hope first to make the administration of all federal justice, from the bottom to the top, speedier, and therefore less costly. Secondly, to bring to the decision of social and economic problems younger men who have had personal experience and contact with modern facts and circumstances under which average men have to live and work.
Notice Roosevelt's description of who was missing from the court. Younger men, not even a thought yet about women, of course, but younger men who have had personal experience with modern facts and circumstances. Not a computer, Justice Breyer might have added. Roosevelt expanded on that idea when his plan was derisively labeled packing the court.
If by that phrase the charge is made that I would appoint and the Senate would confirm justices worthy to sit beside present members of the court who understand modern conditions, that I will appoint justices who will not undertake to override the judgment of the Congress on legislative policy, that I will appoint justices who will act as justices and not as legislators, if the appointment of such justices can be called packing the court, then I say that I, and with me the vast majority of the American people, favor doing just that thing now.
Justices who understand modern conditions, he said. And did you notice he brought in another concept we're debating to this day? Justices who won't legislate from the bench, who will act as justices, not legislators. Now, liberals and conservatives both use that argument. FDR used it to try to get the court to keep its hands off his New Deal programs. Most famous in our generation has probably been Justice Scalia, who used it in the opposite way, to argue not to take modern conditions into account in his rulings.
I don't think we're a leader of social causes. We're not pushing the society ahead. We are supposed to be interpreting the laws that the people have made.
Justice Scalia, an originalist computer, reading the Constitution. What else makes a great Supreme Court justice? Independence from political pressure would be one thing. President Richard Nixon told Justice William Rehnquist that on the phone just after the Senate confirmed Rehnquist in 1972.
I'll give you only one last bit of advice because you're going to be independent, naturally, and that is don't let the fact that you were under heat change any of your views. I'll remember them, so just be as mean and rough as I said you were, okay? Thanks, Mr. President. All right, but just good luck. Thanks. Bye.
A little gem from the Nixon White House tapes, be your mean and rough self and don't let the heat change any of your views. There's that idea again from a Republican president, right? Don't change with the times. Rehnquist pretty much took Nixon's advice, but one of his most famous decisions came nearly 30 years later when he voted to uphold the court's requirement for reading Miranda rights to people when they're arrested. Rehnquist had railed against Miranda rights for decades before that vote. Here's another thing that eventually changed with the times: the value we now place on diversity on the bench. Here is President Reagan, straightforward on the value of diversity, nominating Sandra Day O'Connor in 1981.
Most of the speculation is centered on the question of whether I would consider a woman to fill this first vacancy. As the press has accurately pointed out, during my campaign for the presidency, I made a commitment that one of my first appointments to the Supreme Court vacancy would be the most qualified woman that I could possibly find. Now, this is not to say that I would appoint a woman merely to do so. That would not be fair to women, nor to future generations of all Americans whose lives are so deeply affected by decisions of the court. Rather, I pledge to appoint a woman who meets the very high standards that I demand of all court appointees. I have identified such a person. So today, I'm pleased to announce I will send to the Senate the nomination of Judge Sandra Day O'Connor.
So pretty interesting if you didn't already know it, right? Reagan, an anti-affirmative action Republican, had actually made a campaign promise to nominate a woman to the Supreme Court. He embraced it, and his O'Connor nomination speech there was elegant. But Reagan's successor, George H.W. Bush, was much more awkward when he nominated Clarence Thomas. Remember, this was the opening created by the retirement of Thurgood Marshall, the first African-American justice, and the NAACP lawyer who had successfully argued the Brown versus Board of Education school desegregation case to the court in 1954.
There is very little truth in the old refrain that one cannot legislate equality. Laws not only provide concrete benefits, they can even change the hearts of men. Some men, anyhow, for good or evil.
Thurgood Marshall in 1966, when he was an appeals court judge. So when Marshall retired, Bush 41 was under pressure from the left to not let the court revert to being all white, and under pressure from the right to appoint a conservative. That's how he got Clarence Thomas and this tortured nomination speech by Bush.
But I kept my word to the American people and to the Senate by picking the best man for the job on the merits. And the fact he's minority, so much the better. But that is not the factor, and I would strongly resent any charge that might be forthcoming on quotas when it relates to appointing the best man to the court. That's the kind of thing I stand for, not opposed to.
President George H.W. Bush in 1991, did you even understand that? Squirming to make America believe Clarence Thomas was the most qualified person in America for the Supreme Court and just happened to be black. Of course, you can get in trouble on this from the other side, too. The first two women on the court, O'Connor and Ginsburg, had both said they hoped a wise old man and a wise old woman would reach the same conclusion when deciding cases. But in 2001, a young appeals court judge named Sonia Sotomayor said she hoped that, quote, a wise Latina woman with the richness of her experiences would more often than not reach a better conclusion than a white male who hasn't lived that life, unquote. When President Obama nominated Sotomayor for the Supreme Court in 2009, 8 years later, she had to walk that back.
I want to state up front, unequivocally and without doubt, I do not believe that any ethnic, racial, or gender group has an advantage in sound judging. I do believe that every person has an equal opportunity to be a good and wise judge, regardless of their background or life experiences.
Sonia Sotomayor in 2009. So what makes a great Supreme Court justice? Maybe the last 80 years of history suggests that someone who doesn't legislate from the bench but does take modern conditions into account, someone who doesn't cave to political heat but does allow themselves to change their minds, someone who recognizes that everyone is an individual but that individuals are shaped by their diverse life experiences. Oh, and maybe one other thing. You know how they say justice is supposed to be blind? Maybe it should be a little deaf, too.
The best advice I ever got, and it came from my mother-in-law on the day of my marriage. We were married in her home. She called me into the bedroom and she said, "Dear, I want to tell you something that will stand you in good stead. And that is, in every happy marriage, it helps sometimes to be a little deaf."
Yes.
And yes. That yes. is advice
yes.
that I follow not only in my marriage, but in dealing with my colleagues.
Notorious RBG, Ruth Bader Ginsburg, and that was on ABC in 2010, as she gets the last word in this audio history tour. Let's talk about it a little with Jeff Stone, University of Chicago Law School professor, former law clerk to Supreme Court Justice William Brennan, author of many books, and currently chief editor of a 20-volume series called Inalienable Rights, which is being published by the Oxford University Press. Professor Stone, thanks for coming on. Welcome back to WNYC.
Thanks for having me. Delighted to be here.
I don't have any sound bites earlier than FDR, so does that same tension between sticking to the text of the Constitution and interpreting it for modern times date back even before FDR?
It does. And indeed, one of the things that people don't realize is that the polarization and the conflict over Supreme Court confirmations was actually much greater in the first half of American history than it's been since. In the first half of our history, there were 21 nominations that ultimately either were withdrawn or rejected, whereas in the second half of our history, there have only been eight. So we've actually become less divisive about Supreme Court confirmations and nominations than we used to be. But yes, I think that, from the very beginning, the problem is that the framers drafted a document that is filled with, intentionally filled with, relatively vague statements. Congress shall make no law abridging the freedom of speech. Well, what does that mean? Right? What is the freedom of speech? What does a bridge mean? Why Congress? What about the president? Or no state shall deny any person the equal protection of the laws. What does that mean? Does that mean you can't have rules that say you have to be 16 years old to drive a car or 18 years old to vote because they deny people equal protection of the laws? So clearly the framers intended, understood, and anticipated that these very vague aspirations that they put into the Constitution would have to be given life and would have to be interpreted. And although they had some vague sense of what they might mean in the times in which they lived, they never intended their understanding of what those phrases meant to be definitive for all of history. And so this problem was built into the Constitution from the day it was written.
If most of those rejected as Supreme Court nominees were in the earlier part of the nation's history, were there patterns to that? Were there main reasons that some of those Supreme Court nominees tended to be rejected by the Senate?
In some ways, they were more political than they have been more recently.
Really?
They were individuals who were nominated who were believed to have certain views about particular public policy issues, the power under the Commerce Clause to create a national bank, things like that. And members of the Senate didn't like that. And so a lot of these early defeats were really about very specific issues that were very divisive in the politics of the day.
That's interesting, because it seems to me that the tension, which sounds like it's about the Constitution between originalism and looking at the facts on the ground of the day, that it winds up breaking along partisan lines these days. So if you're a Scalia originalist, your view of the Constitution happens to plunk you down against abortion rights, against voting rights, against affirmative action, against Obamacare. I could go on. And the same on the other side. Is that a coincidence for all this posturing about the Constitution and being above politics? Do presidents really just appoint Supreme Court justices who agree with them on the political issues of the day?
So first of all, your point about originalism. Originalism does not, in fact, explain or justify many of the critical votes cast by Justice Scalia. So originalism would, as he understood the concept, would justify saying there's no constitutional right to same-sex marriage, for example. But it would absolutely lead to the opposite result on issues like affirmative action, on issues like campaign finance reform, on issues like gun control. A true originalist, an honest originalist, would not be politically conservative on those issues. So the difficulty with originalism is that people who purport to use it have not honestly applied it. They've applied it when it led to the results they liked, and they abandon it without ever admitting it when it led to results that they didn't like.
So, unlike what Breyer said on this show in the clip that we played of him here in 2011, you think these appointments are about politics, not constitutional interpretation?
I think that the appointments by presidents are not about constitutional interpretation theories, because those theories are sufficiently ambiguous and vague that they don't really control very much. What matters more, I think, is the way in which an individual potential justice is likely to approach the task of interpreting the Constitution. And political is not quite the right word. Political implies Republican versus Democrat, as opposed to having a certain sense of values that are relevant to the application of the Constitution. So take affirmative action. There are those who believe that any consideration of race is invidious and inappropriate, and there are those who believe that the Equal Protection Clause was about protecting racial minorities from oppressive majorities. Those are both plausible interpretations and understandings of the Constitution, but they lead to very different results on an issue like affirmative action. And you can put forth similar positions with respect to a range of issues, whether it's gun control, abortion, or discrimination on the basis of sexual orientation, or whatever.
It seems to me that it has completely devolved this year into litmus tests on current politics. So if a voter has the Supreme Court in mind this fall, it's going to be to protect or weaken gun rights or protect or weaken police rights, et cetera. Nothing more abstract about the nature of justice or the Constitution. Do you think it's even more this way this year than in the past?
Well, if you go back to the Roosevelt example that you gave, it was about exactly about the same thing. It was about, would you uphold Roosevelt's legislation in the New Deal, or would you strike it down? And that was the key dividing point that Roosevelt was concerned about. So again, it's not unique in any way to this moment for presidents and for the public to be concerned about what are the likely consequences of adding a particular justice to the Supreme Court. The interesting thing, though, is that almost always those justices, particularly in the last 100 years, have in the end been confirmed. If the nominee is reasonably moderate, even if leaning clearly to the right or the left, clearly qualified and clearly ethical, they almost invariably get confirmed.
So let me ask you about a particular piece of history, because after Bork was rejected for being too conservative in the late 80s, there was a time that maybe affected President George H.W. Bush more than anyone, where it became even politically harder to appoint justices who agreed with the president's views or the president's party. I think Justice Souter, appointed by Bush, was picked because he had almost no record on any of the big issues, and so the Democratic Senate couldn't go after him for being too conservative like Bork. Do you see that history that way, and was that an aberration?
Well, do remember that, as you noted earlier, he appointed Clarence Thomas, who was clearly understood to be very conservative. And so I think Bork was kind of unusual. There are very few nominees who are as clearly, defiantly, and unapologetically ideological as Bork was. Now, Bork was basically ideological in the sense of saying he had a theory of constitutional interpretation, and he was sincere about it. But Bork was clearly pretty extreme in terms of the range of views at that time among people who thought about constitutional law. Both before and after Bork, very few Supreme Court nominees have ever had views as strongly predictable as his were. Justice Scalia, remember, was confirmed unanimously.
Incredible. Was he
2 years earlier?
Not an open book. Was he not an open book going in the way that we think of him?
Scalia, everybody knew who Scalia was. I mean, Scalia was very conservative.
And
but
Bork,
he didn't.
Bork was more so.
The difference was that Scalia had the good sense to try to soften it in the confirmation process, and to enable people to think, okay, this guy has written some articles, he's written some opinions that indicate a very strong perspective that's very conservative, but he's persuaded us that he's really a thoughtful, serious thinker who's open to new ideas. Bork ran his confirmation hearings like a law school seminar, trying to persuade everybody why he was right. And I think what he did is he destroyed his own opportunity to appear to be a more reasonable person. And therefore, it was really kind of saying, I dare you. I dare you. Whereas Scalia did the opposite. Scalia softened his views and made it possible for the members of the Senate to come to the view, which turned out to be, I think, inaccurate, that he was a much more modest person than he really was. But Bork was unique in the sense that he defiantly put forth his very radical views and kind of dared the Senate to challenge that.
Before you go, you clerked for Justice Brennan, generally considered one of the great liberal justices of the 20th century. If you think he was a great justice, what made him great?
Brennan was, yes, he was a great justice. He was extremely influential. He was great in a couple of ways. First, he had a very good understanding. This goes back to some of the quotes at the beginning of the show. He had a very good understanding of what I would regard as the fundamental purpose of judicial review, of having a Supreme Court, which is not only to resolve technical legal issues, but in interpreting the Constitution, it's to protect democracy. They're there because the framers of the Constitution understood that majorities at times will be oppressive, they will be discriminatory, they'll be intolerant, they'll be bigoted, and they were nervous about majorities. And one of the things that a Bill of Rights was designed to do, and one of the things that judicial review was designed to do, was to have courts who had life tenure, who were not responsible to the majority, and who had an obligation to interpret and apply the Constitution in its truest sense, rather than to be responsive to the political winds, was to enable them to protect those minorities from overbearing and discriminatory majorities. That was the core function of judicial review. Brennan understood that, and that clearly guided his understanding of the Constitution. I think that's what made him a great justice.
And so anything else you want to say about what makes a great Supreme Court justice, or what would make one at this point in time under a President Clinton or a President Trump?
Well, right now we have an interesting moment because the court is, on most issues, pretty sharply divided, 4-4. Justice Kennedy sometimes does vote with the more liberal wing, but part of what's interesting is it's important to note we've had a conservative majority on the Supreme Court for almost 50 years now. Republican presidents have appointed five or more of the justices since 1969, and this is the first time in almost half a century in which we have the possibility of a majority of the justices being appointed by a Democratic president. And that's what has created the terror on the part of Senate Republicans, is the Supreme Court has been basically a very conservative institution for now the lifetimes of most Americans. And at this moment, there's a possibility of that finally switching. And I think it should switch. I think it's right for there to be these swings within the court. But I think it's clearly terrifying to the Republicans, and that's why we're seeing the behavior towards Merrick Garland that we're seeing.
And that's our 30 Issues election segment, What Makes a Great Supreme Court Justice. We thank University of Chicago Law Professor Jeff Stone for some great context. Thanks very much, Professor.
Thank you for having me. It's a pleasure.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. More to come. Stay with us. WNYC. Now we continue our 30 Issues election special, re-airing another of our audio history segments on a presidential campaign issue. This time, is there a Democratic and Republican way to fight racism? Earlier this summer, we heard the rare spectacle of many Republicans using the words racist and racism to describe their own nominee's language about a Mexican-American judge.
It's sort of like the textbook definition of a racist comment.
Paul Ryan, like you've never heard him before. Mitt Romney, too.
Presidents have an impact on the nature of our nation. And trickle-down racism, trickle-down bigotry, a trickle-down misogyny, all these things are extraordinarily dangerous to the heart and character of America.
They didn't talk like that in 2012 when they were running for president and vice president as a ticket. Those are the most famous now, but hardly the only examples. And they're so striking, not just because of the division within the party at that moment, but because it is so rare to hear Republicans use those words. So for this edition of 30 Issues, we will ask, is there a Democratic and a Republican way to be anti-racist? During the Civil Rights era, the 1950s and early 60s, Southern Democrats were the most anti-civil rights bloc in Congress. Republicans were conservative, but usually not like this.
In the name of the greatest people that have ever trod this earth, I draw the line in the dust and toss the gauntlet before the feet of tyranny, and I say segregation now, segregation tomorrow, and segregation forever.
Alabama Governor George Wallace, a Democrat in 1963. By contrast, when Richard Nixon ran for president in 1960, it wasn't surprising to hear him talk like this.
I want to talk to you for a moment about civil rights, equal rights for all our citizens. Why must we vigorously defend them? First, because it is right and just. And second, because we cannot compete successfully with communism if we fail to utilize completely the minds and energies of all of our citizens. And third, The whole world is watching us.
Nixon, as a Republican, got a third of the black vote that year in defeat. When he was elected president in 1968, things had changed and he only got 15% and just 13% in his reelection in 1972 when he ran campaign ads like this against busing for integration.
It's wrong for the white children. It's wrong for the black children. That will have the effect of creating hatreds, hatreds among the kids. Their lives should not be experimented with. Their education should not be affected in a detrimental way. That's what the busing is all about.
Whether busing was a good idea or not, running a campaign commercial like that was intended to appeal to white resentment. Language about the importance of civil rights was gone. It's come to be known as the Southern Strategy, in which Nixon consciously appealed to white Southerners who felt abandoned by the Democrats' embrace of the civil rights laws of the 60s. The strategy has become a permanent partisan divide. No Republican presidential candidate has gotten more than 15% of the black vote since. In four of the last eight presidential elections, they've been in single digits. One expression of this is that Republican presidential candidates have tended to emphasize racial progress rather than inequality, while Democrats talk more about the need for more change. Here's a representative exchange between Ronald Reagan and Jimmy Carter in a 1980 televised debate when they were asked about the nation's future as a multiracial society.
I believe in it. I am eternally optimistic, and I happen to believe that we've made great progress from the days when I was young and when this country didn't even know it had a racial problem.
Governor Reagan said that when he was a younger man, that there was no knowledge of a racial problem in this country. Those who suffered from discrimination because of race or sex certainly knew we had a racial problem. We have gone a long way toward correcting these problems, but we still have a long way to go.
In 1984 and 88, the presidential primary season really sounded different for a while when the number two Democrat in the race was the Reverend Jesse Jackson. In 84, for example, he implied that whites were making racist assumptions about his knowledge of foreign policy.
What the blacks know about foreign policy? It's an insult! I was 3 years old. I came into my consciousness. My daddy was coming home from the war. Foreign policy. If he was so dumb, how'd he get over there and get back? If he didn't know foreign policy, why'd they give him a gun? And when they gave it to him, he knew which way to shoot. We know foreign policy.
In 1988, the George H.W. Bush campaign ran what many consider the most blatant appeal to racism in modern presidential campaign history, the so-called Willie Horton ad, which showed the black face of a murderer by that name as it aired this audio.
Bush and Dukakis on crime. Bush supports the death penalty for first-degree murderers. Dukakis not only opposes the death penalty, he allowed first-degree murderers to have weekend passes from prison. One was Willie Horton, who murdered a boy in a robbery, stabbing him 19 times. Despite a life sentence, Horton received 10 weekend passes from prison. Horton fled, kidnapped a young couple, stabbing the man and repeatedly raping his girlfriend. Weekend prison passes. Dukakis on crime.
Bush's campaign manager that year, Lee Atwater, on his deathbed a few years later, apologized for the implied racism of that campaign and that campaign ad. Bush only got 10% of the black vote, just 11% when he lost his reelection bid to Bill Clinton in 1992 after appointing Clarence Thomas to succeed Thurgood Marshall on the Supreme Court. Even Clinton, in his New Democrat campaign to show he was no liberal ideologue or no old-fashioned liberal, made a point of talking back to rap artist Sister Souljah and making a show of saying blacks could be racists too in a speech to Jesse Jackson's Rainbow Coalition.
Last year she said, "You can't call me or any black person anywhere in the world a racist. We don't have the power to do to white people what white people have done to us. And even if we did, we don't have that low-down, dirty nature. If there are any good white people, I haven't met them. Where are they? Right here in this room. That's where they are. I know she is a young person, but she has a big influence on a lot of people. And when people say that, if you took the words white and black and you reversed them, you might think David Duke was giving that speech."
Bill Clinton during the 92 campaign. Of course, that wasn't the only way he talked about race. And he went on to become very popular in black communities in some cases even getting the nickname the first black president years before Obama. And that popularity is something that Hillary Clinton benefited from tremendously in her campaign against Bernie Sanders this year. 1996 was an interesting presidential campaign year for language about race. Republican Bob Dole, trying to unseat Clinton, chose former HUD Secretary Jack Kemp as his running mate. Kemp, a white conservative who nonetheless had a reputation for being serious about racial equality.
I wasn't there when Rosa Parks took a stand by remaining in her seat on Cleveland Avenue in Montgomery, Alabama, in December of 1955, and I wasn't there when my friend John Lewis was beaten or when Dr. King was in a jail or marched to Selma. But I'm here today, and I'm here with Bob Dole to help forge a new civil rights agenda, an agenda of expanded ownership and empowerment with jobs and educational choice and entrepreneurship and the equality of opportunity in which any child of God can rise to his or her potential.
There was a joke I heard in 1996 that said the Republicans should run a ticket of Jack Kemp and Colin Powell because Colin Powell would attract a lot of whites to vote for him and Kemp would get a lot of blacks. But the nominee at the top of the ticket was not Colin Powell. It was Bob Dole, who spoke a decent game about ongoing inequality, but used that language to couch his change of heart away from affirmative action.
Many black Americans, as well as others, still do not share fully in America's bounties and still lack the opportunities that most others have. And some believe the solution to these problems is quotas and preferences and set-asides. And I've supported race-based preferences in the past, but over time I realized that preferences created with the best of intentions were dividing America instead of bringing us or bringing them together. What I do support and what I do define as real affirmative action is aggressive, determined, and persistent recruitment of minorities and women by business, government, and universities. It also means identifying barriers to advancement of women and minorities in corporate America.
Bob Dole in 1996. As for that second George Bush, how different did he sound from Trump when promoting comprehensive immigration reform in 2006?
Our new immigrants are just what they've always been. People willing to risk everything for the dream of freedom. And America remains what she has always been. The great hope on the horizon. An open door to the future. A blessed and promised land. We honor the heritage of all who come here. No matter where they come from. Because we trust in our country's genius for making us all Americans.
Bush got 40% of the Latino vote in his 2004 reelection. Mitt Romney only got 27% after suggesting self-deportation. Our first black president has been generally circumspect on race. No white America, no black America has been his brand and his guiding star. But he would occasionally refer to racism in a first-person way that none of the 43 white presidents before him could.
When Trayvon Martin was first shot, I said that this could have been my son. Another way of saying that is Trayvon Martin could have been me 35 years ago.
That's a far cry from what we heard from the Republican nominee.
Look at my African-American over here. Look at him. Are you the greatest? Do you know what I'm talking about?
And that's this week's 30 Issues audio history essay to set up, is there a Democratic and Republican way to talk about race? With me now for a few minutes to talk about some of those history clips and the notion in general of a Democratic and Republican way to be anti-racist since the Civil Rights Movement is Peniel Joseph, the founding director of the Center for the Study of Race and Democracy and professor of history at the University of Texas, Austin, and author of books including Dark Days, Bright Nights, From Black Power to Barack Obama. Peniel, thanks for doing this with us. Always good to have you on the show. Welcome back to WNYC.
Oh, thanks for having me, Brian.
Let's go back to the beginning of that timeline. Obviously, you know the classic George Wallace segregation forever clip. He was a Democrat and typical of many Southern Democrats then. Be curious to get your impression one day of working in Texas when you used to work at Tufts in Massachusetts. But we're seeing the fraying of the Republican Party today over Trumpism and race. given the George Wallaces on the one hand and the Northern Liberals on the other, was it inevitable that the Democratic Party would break up, as it really did in the 60s over civil rights?
Well, yeah. I mean, I think when we think about the party's anti-racism, especially post-1965, they both have had their anti-racist philosophy, and I think both of those have changed over time. Certainly, when we look at post-Lyndon Johnson, George Wallace is a populist Democrat who really is concerned about white working-class voters, and he uses race both to attract and recruit them, but also to point out economic inequality. So Wallace is very, very interesting in that sense that he's a populist who's criticizing certain aspects of capitalism and sort of economic exploitation, but he's also racist in the sense that he's accusing black people and white elites of conspiring against white working class and poor people. Over time, that's going to change. When we think about, Richard Nixon's very intriguing because his first term, he tries to push for affirmative action, has a special black assistant, Arthur Fletcher, and really draws a huge amount of support relatively from civil rights activists who believe that Nixon is going to empower them economically. What happens is that there becomes a backlash against affirmative action as early as the early 1970s, even before the Bakke case in 1978. And so Nixon, by the second term, he really disappoints his African-American supporters because he's not as supportive of affirmative action. He decides to double down on the white working class, the construction workers. We have the famous construction worker riot in the early 70s who are pro-Nixon, and he wins 49 states in 1972. So over time, the Republican anti-racist strategy becomes a strategy of saying they support civil rights in principle, but they support the old civil rights, meaning they support the Voting Rights Act, the Civil Rights Act, but they're not interested in enforcement. Enforcement is too intrusive, whereas Democrats are going to be, their anti-racist philosophy is going to be vigorous enforcement of existing civil rights laws, but also the expansion of desegregation through busing and through other measures.
And so we get Nixon versus busing, Reagan for getting the government, quote, off our backs in general, also Reagan versus so-called welfare queens, Bob Dole versus affirmative action, as we heard in that clip, et cetera.
Yeah, absolutely. And Reagan becomes interesting because Reagan is going to really deviate from Ford Nixon in a way, because what his anti-racist philosophy, it's really, there's a kind of realpolitik to it in the sense that Reagan is going to rhetorically support civil rights, but he's going to, in contrast to Richard Nixon, really recruit a new generation of black neoconservatives. And these were African Americans who weren't just conservative in a Booker T. Washington sense, because Booker T. Washington would have supported affirmative action. He was a strong race man, even though he opposed vigorous civil rights demonstrations. These new black conservatives, people like Thomas Sowell, Clarence Thomas, Glenn Lowry in the 1980s, they rejected any kind of support for civil rights that had to do with affirmative action or that took race into account. And Reagan fills his Justice Department, his civil rights commissions, his equal opportunity commissions with those kind of blacks. And that's a game changer. That's something that's new. And Democrats really don't quite know how to respond to that because it's very difficult to oppose in that context in the 1980s and 1990s a black person who has achieved and is being appointed by a president who says they're for civil rights, but then who's really in opposition to any kind of civil rights enforcement. And I think it's only until recently, post Clarence Thomas, that Democrats had a bigger handle on how to oppose black neoconservatives.
Huh. What do you make of the Paul Ryan and Mitt Romney statements? Romney coining the phrase trickle-down racism, as we heard in that clip announcing he'll not vote for Trump. I don't think he ever talked like that when he was running for president.
No, I think this is extraordinary, and I think it's very ironic, because I think what Romney and Paul Ryan did was acknowledge the fact that Trump has gone too far in his rhetoric. But, you know, the Republican Party in the post-civil rights period has historically used what Ian Hanley-Lopez calls dog whistle politics, meaning that they use racially coded language. You referred to Ronald Reagan's infamous 1976 primary quote about welfare queens, where Reagan took a story about a black woman who had taken about $800 in extra benefits and turned it into about $80,000 in extra benefits through hyperbole. And Reagan really is one of the innovators, Nixon too, with the silent majority, of this idea of coded racial language. I think Trump makes people uncomfortable because he's not using codes. He's very much overtly pointing out that, you know, Muslims, Latinos, these are people who are the enemy. And I think that what we're seeing with Romney and Paul Ryan is that there's a group of Republicans who feel uncomfortable with this rhetoric, even though in the past they were fine with the implications of coded rhetoric.
And how about the Democrats, before you go, not to let them off the hook? If Democrats are routinely getting 90% of the vote for president among African Americans, how much do you see Democratic language evolving to appeal to black and other voters concerned with anti-racism? And how much do you think there's a taking those voters for granted that we see in their actions or even in their words?
Well, I think we've seen much more of the latter in terms of taking voters for granted. I think, in a way, the high point of this is going to be Clintonism, because basically, and you had some great quotes from former President Bill Clinton. Clinton has it both ways. He says, especially to the black middle class and the elites, he's going to reach out to them. He's their friend. He has an open door to the White House, to people like Toni Morrison. Cornel West visits the Clinton White House. Many different African Americans who never had that kind of access to presidential power. At the same time, both him and Hillary, you know, they're talking about super predators, mass incarceration. They sign a very draconian crime bill, welfare reform bill that really impacts African Americans. So he has it both ways. What's interesting for Democrats, it's recently with the Black Lives Matter movement that there's a call to sort of hold Democrats accountable, both in the primary season and in this election. And when we think about Barack Obama, he's been intriguing because he's the first black Democrat and black elected official, black president, who did not need any mediators between him and the black constituency. So he receives an extraordinary number of black votes in 2008, but he receives 1.8 million more black votes in 2012. I mean, the most extraordinary aspect of the 2012 election is that there's 2 million white voters who disappear from the electoral rolls, and there's 1.8 million new blacks who appear suddenly and vote for him, and you have the biggest black participation ever, percentage-wise, in American history, that actually outstrips the white vote. So we can make an argument that Obama continues this idea of sort of taking black votes for granted, because many black elites black people criticized the Obama administration for not taking up a black agenda, even as he took up immigration reform. He did wonderful things in terms of LGBT and gay marriage, but he never really explicitly took up that anti-racist banner. And I think people are holding Hillary Clinton and Bernie Sanders their feet to the fire in a way that we really haven't seen since the 1960s.
We thank for filling us in on, is there a Democratic and Republican way to fight racism? University of Texas historian Peniel Joseph, author of books including Dark Days, Bright Nights, From Black Power to Barack Obama. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having me, Brian.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Up next after the news, more audio history of the issues in this year's election. But first, it's time for the latest news, live from the WNYC newsroom. It's the Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC. Good morning again, everyone. Now we continue our 30 Issues election special, re-airing another of our audio history segments on a presidential campaign issue. This time, the top three things to do about climate change. I'll bet you didn't know you could have seen a warning about global warming just by watching television in 1958, the Bell Telephone Science Hour.
Even now, man may be unwittingly changing the world's climate through the waste products of his civilization. Due to our release through factories and automobiles every year of more than 6 billion tons of carbon dioxide, which helps air absorb heat from the sun, our atmosphere seems to be getting warmer.
The Bell Telephone Science Hour aired on TV in 1958. You know, that was produced by the legendary director Frank Capra. A little more prehistory. Anyone remember the 1973 movie Soylent Green with Charlton Heston and Edward G. Robinson, who speaks first in this clip?
Why, in my day, you could buy meat anywhere. Eggs they had, real butter, fresh lettuce in the stores.
I know, Saul, you told me before.
How can anything survive in a climate like this? A heat wave all year long.
The greenhouse effect. Everything is burning up.
Okay, wise guy.
Okay, so that was science fiction. But the writers had global warming on their minds in 1973. Maybe they had grown up watching the Bell Telephone Science Hour. Soylent Green, by the way, was Edward G. Robinson's last movie. Gradually, scientists were coming to think the Earth might have a major problem on its hands. Here's one of the seminal moments in the public profile of the issue. In 1979, climatologist Stephen Schneider of Stanford reversed his previous position that the Earth might be about to start cooling, and he went public with his concern about warming. Schneider, as some of you know, later shared the Nobel Peace Prize with Al Gore after Gore's global warming movie, An Inconvenient Truth, came out. That was in 2006. But back in 1979, as a good scientist does, Steve Schneider was changing his mind with new evidence and pointing out uncertainties as that evidence emerged.
Scientific consensus that CO2 will build up and will be a potential problem is very large, but a scientific consensus on precisely how influential it will be in 10 years or 20 years, what areas climates will get better, what areas will get worse, this is where the controversy comes in. So what we're really doing is we're insulting our global environment at a faster rate than we're understanding it. And the best we can do, in all honesty, is say, look out, there's a chance of potentially irreversible change at a global scale based upon the benefits of use of energy, and it's very tough for us to know whether those benefits of energy today are worth the potential risks of environmental change for our children.
Scientist Steve Schneider in 1979, not sure if the energy sources of that time were a danger to our children. Over the years, he became much more sure. We'll hear another clip of him later. Besides sharing the Nobel Peace Prize with Al Gore more than 25 years later, he was such a respected climatologist that he advised the White House under Presidents Nixon, Carter, Reagan, Bush 41, Clinton, Bush 43, and Obama. Stephen Schneider died in 2010. A giant in the history of climate science, in no small measure for having changed his mind in light of new evidence. So that was Steve Schneider making a little bit of news in 1979. It made much bigger news in 1988 when Dr. James Hansen, director of NASA's Institute for Space Studies, became convinced that global warming was a major threat and testified about it before Congress. All we could find from the testimony was these 9 crucial seconds laid into a documentary with a music bed.
Altogether, this evidence represents a very strong case, in my opinion, that the greenhouse effect has been detected and it is changing our climate now.
And this is WNYC FM HD and AM New York, WNJT FM 88.1 Trenton, WNJP 88.5 Sussex, WNJY 89.3 Netcong, and WNJO 90.3 Toms River. We're in New York and New Jersey public radio. So with respected scientists like Hansen and Schneider, with no ideological axe to grind, sounding the alarm, the UN that year, 1988, set up its Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, which leads the scientific inquiry into the field to this day. And world governments went to work on a global treaty to limit greenhouse gases, like they had recently done with chlorofluorocarbons, or CFCs, that had been causing a dangerous hole in the ozone layer. Anyone remember the hole in the ozone layer? Well, the ozone layer fix was effective. It was a hybrid government and market-based system known as cap and trade. The treaty determined how much total CFCs the atmosphere could handle. The market component allowed companies to buy and sell those limited pollution rights. In 1997, the first major global warming treaty was signed in Kyoto, Japan. Vice President Al Gore represented the United States.
We came to Kyoto to find new ways to bridge our differences. In doing so, however, we must not waver in our resolve. For our part, the United States remains firmly committed to a strong, binding target that will reduce our own emissions by nearly 30% from what they would otherwise be, a commitment as strong or stronger than any we have heard here from any country. The imperative here is to do what we promise rather than to promise what we cannot do.
Now, the U.S. was originally a party to the Kyoto Protocol because the Clinton administration was there, but the Senate overwhelmingly rejected it because it demanded much more of the U.S. than of China and other developing countries. In a reversal from President Bill Clinton's support, President George W. Bush rejected the treaty when he took office in 2001 because of China's privileges. But note in this 2001 clip that he accepted global warming as real.
We recognize a responsibility to reduce our emissions. We also recognize the other part of the story, that the rest of the world emits 80% of all greenhouse gases, and many of those emissions come from developing countries. This is a challenge that requires a 100% effort, ours and the rest of the world's. The world's second largest emitter of greenhouse gases is China, yet China was entirely exempted from the requirements of the Kyoto Protocol.
The Kyoto Protocol took effect in 2005, with the vast majority of the world's nations adopting the emission reduction rules, but the U.S. and Russia refusing. With the federal government under Bush not taking the lead on global warming, California's Republican governor, Arnold Schwarzenegger, did. As the state with by far the biggest population, California by itself could affect the type of cars and other products produced by passing environmental laws. In the case of global warming, it was an emission caps law that Schwarzenegger signed in 2006 and defended in a speech to the state Republican convention in 2007. By then, many Republicans were denying even the existence of global warming as a scientific fact.
According to the polls, nearly three-quarters of our own party supports the global warming bill that I signed last year. They won. They want this party to do something more about climate change than simply doubt it. If it is the party's policy, if it is the policy of the Republican Party to ignore the great majority of the world's scientists and ignore the view of the 80-90% of the young people who believe the same, then that party is at odds with the future. The Republican Party needs once again to be the party of Teddy Roosevelt's conservationists.
Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger, who signed the California emissions bill in 2006. That was the same year that Al Gore released his global warming documentary, An Inconvenient Truth. Here's 30 seconds from the trailer.
Scientific consensus is that we are causing global warming. I am Al Gore. I used to be the next president of the United States of America. This is Patagonia, 75 years ago, and the same glacier today. This is Mount Kilimanjaro, 30 years ago, and last year. Within the decade, there will be no more snows of Kilimanjaro.
This is really not a political issue so much as a moral issue. Temperature increases are taking place all over the world,
and that's causing stronger storms.
For An Inconvenient Truth, Al Gore won a 2006 Oscar and a 2007 Nobel Peace Prize. So along comes the 2008 presidential election, and here's my nominee for most forgotten fact about global warming politics. The Democratic candidate Barack Obama and the Republican candidate John McCain both acknowledge the reality of climate change and both endorse the cap-and-trade system for limiting total emissions but letting the market sort out which companies could pollute.
I'm in favor of cap and trade. And Joe Lieberman and I, one of my favorite Democrats, and I have proposed that when we did the same thing with acid rain. They're doing it in Europe now, although not very well. And all we are saying is, look, if you can reduce your greenhouse gas emissions, you earn a credit. Somebody else is going to increase theirs. You can sell it to them. And meanwhile, we have a gradual reduction in greenhouse gas emissions. We need a global agreement, but it has to include India and China. We need to go back to nuclear power. We cannot be dependent on $400 billion a year paying for foreign oil. There's a nexus here. But climate change, in my view, is real.
My presidency will mark a new chapter in America's leadership on climate change that will strengthen our security and create millions of new jobs in the process. That will start with a federal cap and trade system. We'll establish strong annual targets that set us on a course to reduce emissions to their 1990 levels by 2020 and reduce them an additional 80% by 2050. Further, we'll invest $15 billion each year to catalyze private sector efforts to build a clean energy future. We'll invest in solar power, wind power, and next-generation biofuels. We'll tap nuclear power while making sure it's safe. And we will develop clean coal technologies.
With both candidates on board, it looked like a lock that greenhouse gas emissions would finally be capped in the United States after the 2008 election. But when Obama was elected, the Republicans in Congress bolted the consensus. They rebranded cap and trade a carbon tax and blocked any legislation. The Republicans won a House majority in 2010, and what did they do with it? In 2011, their first year in power, the new Speaker, John Boehner, abolished the Global Warming Committee. In the 2012 presidential race, Mitt Romney accepted global warming as real, but rejected policy solutions because of a new kind of political rationale. It was real, but not necessarily man-made.
My view is that we don't know what's causing climate change on this planet, and the idea of spending trillions and trillions of dollars to try and reduce CO2 emissions is not the right course for us.
Romney in 2012. Now, the Nobel Prize-winning climatologist Steve Schneider had anticipated this kind of delinking back in 2007 when he talked about the science and the politics.
And some people have said, well, the Earth has warmed and cooled before. This could just be natural. And in fact, some element of it must be natural. Changes in the energy output of the sun, the internal flipping of energy between the oceans and the atmosphere. But in the last 30 years, it's taken a jump up that's not apparent in anything in the last several thousand years.
So the Republicans walked away from global warming as a legislative issue. But the Obama administration has made a major breakthrough in global warming diplomacy, getting China to agree to its first ever promise to slow its carbon growth. Remember, China was the stumbling block for previous Republican presidents and candidates. China will slow its carbon growth in exchange for U.S. reductions. And that brings us to this year's campaign. Hillary Clinton was Secretary of State when that agreement was being negotiated, and tells this behind-the-scenes story from the Copenhagen Climate Summit in her first year in office.
When we met in Copenhagen in 2009, and literally President Obama and I were hunting for the Chinese, going throughout this huge convention center because we knew we had to get them to agree to something. Because there will be no effective efforts against climate change unless China and India join with the rest of the world. They told us they'd left for the airport. We found out they were having a secret meeting. We marched up. We broke in. We said, we've been looking all over for you. Let's sit down and talk about what we need to do. And we did come up with the first international agreement that China has signed. Thanks to President Obama's leadership, it's now gone much further.
Clinton at the first Democratic debate last summer on CNN. Also in that debate, they were asked what they considered the biggest national security threats. Clinton cited military and terrorism threats, but Bernie Sanders surprised most of the audience by declaring climate change to be the number one national security threat to the United States. Some of you heard that, bigger than ISIS. Clinton and Sanders also disagreed on how to fight climate change. She proposes a big investment in solar panels and other renewable energy technologies and promises that those positive programs will lead to a 30% reduction in carbon emissions over time, while Sanders wanted a carbon tax. Sanders for a carbon tax, Clinton opposed. One of the key differences between them in the Democratic primaries. And as for Donald Trump?
So Obama's talking about all of this with the global warming and that. A lot of it's a hoax. It's a hoax. I mean, it's a money-making industry, okay? It's a hoax. A lot of it. Look, I want clean air and I want clean water. That's my global. I want clean, clean, crystal water. And I want clean air. And we can do that. But we don't have to destroy our businesses.
It's a hoax. We've come a long way from John McCain. And from the Bell Telephone Science Hour in 1958 to Clinton, Sanders, and Trump in this campaign, that's our brief audio history of the global warming debate. Coming up next, an annotated history of some of these same clips with commentary by environment reporter Andrew Revkin of the New York Times. Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Stay with us. Brian Lehrer on WNYC, and now we continue our 30 Issues election special with an annotated audio history of how to stop global warming. You heard us play about 15 clips ranging from a TV documentary that warned of global warming back in the 1950s through the candidates today. And now we will replay a few selected clips from that set and put them into historical and political context with a great and very knowledgeable guest, the veteran New York Times environment correspondent, Andrew Revkin. These days he writes the .earth blog at the Times website and is the Senior Fellow for Environmental Understanding, what a title, at Pace University. Hi, Andy. Welcome back to WNYC.
It's great to be with you.
And let's go back to the first clip from yesterday, the Bell Telephone Science Hour, which aired in 1958. This was produced by Frank Capra.
Even now, man may be unwittingly changing the world's climate through the waste products of his civilization. Due to our release through factories and automobiles every year of more than 6 billion tons of carbon dioxide, which helps air absorb heat from the sun, our atmosphere seems to be getting warmer.
Wow. Now, besides that old Voice of God documentary announcer style, how ahead of their time was that, mentioning global warming from energy emissions in 1958?
Well, I have to say the Times beat them. There was a really good story in 1956 in the New York Times, the year I was born, that had all the same points in it that I've made in every story I've been writing about global warming since 1988, essentially greenhouse gases function. And by the way, of course, the science goes back to the early 19th century, the basics. But the idea that it was happening, that was connected to industry, that article in 1956 by the immortal Waldemar Kempfert, this is before Walter Sullivan even, who was kind of the dean of science journalism. It basically said coal and oil, the end of the story said coal and oil are still plentiful and it will be burned by industry as long as it pays to do so. That was 1956.
What was the name of the writer?
Waldemar Kempfert.
And that was before Harry Potter.
Yeah, if people Google for 1956 climate Revkin Times, like I've posted it before.
So. Just as an aside, did you know that Frank Capra, probably most famous for his Christmas movie, It's a Wonderful Life, of course, did a handful of those science documentaries for Bell Telephone in the 50s as a way of working again after falling victim to the McCarthy-era blacklists.
Fascinating.
At least that's what I read.
There's one other element of that clip I got to talk about. There's a section where it shows Miami. It's cartoon, and there's water level is way up high, and there are gondolas like you might have in Venice over the buildings of Miami. And they mention, and sea levels could rise 150 feet. And actually, that's correct. But on a monthly 1,000-year time scale, there was a recent paper just last year that I wrote about that said we are now, in the next 100 years, we're basically setting the sea level for the next 10,000 years. And the high level would be pretty much what they show in that film.
I heap praise on the late, great Stanford climatologist Stephen Schneider, who shared the Nobel Peace Prize with Al Gore when Gore won it for his climate documentary, of course, An Inconvenient Truth. And Schneider had actually been more concerned about global cooling briefly in the early 70s, then came around, based on new evidence, to suspect serious warming. Here again is Schneider, as great scientists will do, acknowledging uncertainty about the severity of global warming's potential effects.
Scientific consensus that CO2 will build up and will be a potential problem is very large. But a scientific consensus on precisely how influential it will be in 10 years or 20 years, what areas climates will get better, what areas will get worse, this is where the controversy comes in. So what we're really doing is we're insulting our global environment at a faster rate than we're understanding it. And the best we can do, in all honesty, is say, look out, there's a chance of potentially irreversible change at a global scale based upon the benefits of use of energy, and it's very tough for us to know whether those benefits of energy today are worth the potential risks of environmental change for our children.
So that was 1979. He came to be much more certain over time. Can you talk a little bit about Schneider's scientific evolution?
Totally. I first met him in 1985. 1985 is when I first wrote about the human relationship to the climate system, but it was about nuclear winter. That was the Cold War. This is different than the next ice age. Cold War, nuclear war, particles in the atmosphere, cooling. And they were running the tests of that on climate models in Boulder, and Steve was there. And I basically grew up studying this question with Steve, one of the key voices in my brain, from 1985 right through until he died a few years ago, sadly, way too early. And he was always very cognizant of uncertainty. Some scientists and activists have tended to gloss over the real profound uncertainties. We still don't know how warm the world's going to get from a certain buildup of CO2. He was quite clear about that and said that, but uncertainty is not your friend. You know, he would cast it as the reason to act, which we do in other arenas routinely. We don't spend $800 billion in defense, whatever that number is these days, because we know we're going to fight a war next week. We spend it to limit the risks of war. So Steve was very good at that. But he still was attacked routinely.
Indeed. And let's jump way ahead to 2008, when, as I brought up, and people forget, both presidential candidates that year, Obama and McCain, embraced global warming as real and had the same core solution, which was a cap-and-trade system under which government would set the total national limit on emissions based on what was deemed safe for the earth and that they could get through Congress, and companies could buy and sell the pollution credits, basically in the private sector. We know Obama's position, but we forget that McCain was running on a pro-cap-and-trade Republican platform as well. Listen.
I'm in favor of cap-and-trade. And Joe Lieberman and I, one of my favorite Democrats, and I have proposed that and we did the same thing with acid rain. They're doing it in Europe now, although not very well. And all we are saying is, look, if you can reduce your greenhouse gas emissions, you earn a credit. Somebody else is going to increase theirs. You can sell it to them. And meanwhile, we have a gradual reduction in greenhouse gas emissions. We need a global agreement, but it has to include India and China. We need to go back to nuclear power. We cannot be dependent on $400 billion a year paying for foreign oil. There's a nexus here. But climate change, in my view, is real.
John McCain in 2008 running for president. Andy Revkin from the Times.Earth blog, my guest. So politically, what happened? If McCain and Obama were both for it, why did the Republican Congress totally obstruct cap and trade like 10 minutes later after Obama was elected?
Oh, God. Well, and why did McCain reverse himself on the issue as well? I interviewed him around that same time. He had gone to the Arctic. I've written a ton about the Arctic, and this is 2005. He was very concerned. I interviewed Gingrich. It's interesting in the context of what's happening right now with Trump.
He also reversed himself.
Exactly.
There was one of the clips we almost pulled was Gingrich sitting with Nancy Pelosi in around 2005. They made a commercial together. It was global warming is real. We have to do something. And then when he was running for president, Gingrich said, that's the stupidest thing I ever said.
Yeah. The problem with what happened after that, the late sort of the end of the first decade of this millennium, the polarization became so complete around global warming that you couldn't be a Republican and be worried about it publicly. And you couldn't be a Democrat and have the opposite view. So and that really toxified the discussion about legislation, the climate bill. I wrote a lot about what happened around the failure of that climate bill. One of the things that he mentioned, though, he mentioned the word nuclear. And that one reason that years earlier, McCain was a co-author of the McCain-Lieberman climate bill. This is 2003, 2004.
He mentioned it in that clip.
And the reason environmental groups pulled out of support for that bill was McCain insisted that nuclear have a role. And I remember some conversations in Washington, walking down the green there somewhere with with the head of one of the big environmental groups. You know, so why in the world is that? And you know, part of that is just the, well, you've probably done entire other segments on, you know, the graying sure. environmental movement is still stuck in the, you know, Three Mile Island history. And it's hard to make that, you're going to hear more about that, I think, in the coming months. If you're worried about climate change and you're not accepting nuclear power, then what's your story? It gets to be interesting.
As we continue in our 30 Issues Election Special, an annotated political history of the global warming debate, playing clips from the past, talking about some of them with Andrew Revkin, who writes the NewYorkTimes.Earth blog. And so getting to today, Hillary Clinton wants to reduce carbon emissions by 30%, she says, by investing and developing massive solar panel conversion and other things that are renewable energy sources. Sanders also wanted to disincentivize carbon with a carbon tax. But when Congress was opposing Obama's cap and trade, they said, well, it's really a carbon tax in disguise. So what's the difference between a cap and trade system and a simple carbon tax?
Well, there are many approaches to a tax. You could go for hours on this. The one that is gaining support even from some moderate Republicans is a fee and dividend system where the tax is applied to the extractors of the fuels and then the consumers get a rebate in some way or other that lets them be shielded from the impact. So you're disincentivizing the fossil fuel, but you're not making people broke. Try explaining that, though, in a campaign soundbite.
Yeah.
And that's been out there for a number of years. Jim Hansen, a leading scientist who's been pursuing progress, is focused on that. But of course, you know, I got to back up to the global scale because global warming is, quote unquote, global. The problem here with this issue is that America is kind of a sideshow now, one way or the other. And Republicans will make this argument, and they'll be right about it, that virtually all of the growth in emissions of these gases that trap heat is coming in developing countries in the next few decades. It's a big pulse of them getting to be like us. And that gets to this question of the treaty and are we obligated, do we have a responsibility to help the developing countries develop more cleanly? They're not going to pay that premium unless the technology is cheaper than coal. And so it gets quickly away from the things that a presidential candidate can control. And that's why, you know, in writing about global warming since the 80s, I've actually not paid too much attention to the presidential details because in the end, leadership matters there, but it won't be the thing that necessarily will change the scope of this problem going forward.
The Times had a story about Democratic constituencies being divided on global warming, environmentalists rising in power in the party, strong on doing something, but construction unions that want jobs building gas pipelines and things like that, getting very alienated. How seriously do you think they're divided?
I think that's an issue. You know, everyone wants to get out the vote. And the environmental vote still is a very small chunk of the electorate. It can be a very, you know, visible chunk. Bill McKibben et al. Are great at telling the story of the problems with fossil fuels. But it is still a sideshow. Most people, when you look at polls, you know, if you're a strategist and you're advising a presidential candidate, unless you're dealing with some vote that's very much about that little margin, this is not an issue for you.
And so does that explain Donald Trump? This is how far we've come in 6 short years from John McCain.
So Obama's talking about all of this with the global warming and a lot of it's a hoax. It's a hoax. I mean, it's a money-making industry, okay? It's a hoax. A lot of it. Look, I want clean air and I want clean water. That's my global. I want clean, clean, crystal water. And I want clean air. And we can do that. But we don't have to destroy our businesses.
It's a hoax. And it'll destroy our businesses.
But he puts in those little things like most of it. You know, you'll see. I think he's a shapeshifter. Obviously, he's like the ultimate shapeshifter, I think. I would predict that some of that will become nuanced fairly quickly. Not yet, but soon. But I, you know, whether there's a depth to conviction one way or the other, only Donald knows, I think.
Andrew Revkin, thanks a lot.
It's great to be here.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. More to come. Stay with us. We'll be right back. Brian Lehrer on WNYC, and now we continue our 30 Issues election special. Today, we airing another of our audio history segments on a presidential campaign issue of today, this time health insurance, public and private. Now, this was from April, when multiple Republicans and Bernie Sanders were still in the race for their party's nominations. The struggle that resulted in Obamacare, or the Affordable Care Act, goes back at least to President Harry Truman in 1948.
The greatest gap in our Social Security structure is the lack of adequate provision for the nation's health. We are rightly proud of the high standards of medical care we know how to provide in the United States. The fact is, however, that most of our people cannot afford to pay for the care they need. I have often and strongly urged that this condition demands a national health program. The heart of the program must be a national system of payment for medical care based on well-tried insurance principles. This great nation cannot afford to allow its citizens to suffer needlessly from the lack of proper medical care. Our ultimate aim must be a comprehensive insurance system to protect all our people equally against insecurity and ill health.
President Harry Truman, in his State of the Union address in 1948, it's easy for us to forget that it was only 50 years ago that the United States had no Medicaid, government health insurance for the poor, and no Medicare, government health insurance for the elderly. Here is President Lyndon Johnson signing Medicare into law on July 30th, 1965.
No longer will older Americans be denied the healing miracle of modern medicine. No longer will illness crush and destroy the savings that they have so carefully put away over a lifetime so that they might enjoy dignity in their later years. No longer will young families see their own incomes and their own hopes eaten away simply because they're carrying out their deep moral obligations to their parents and to their uncles and their aunts. And no longer will this nation refuse the hand of justice to those who have given a lifetime of service and wisdom and labor to the progress of this progressive country.
That signing by President Johnson, fittingly, was at the Harry Truman Library at Independence, Missouri. At one point in the ceremony, Johnson turned to Truman, who was in the audience and who couldn't pass a health insurance law in his own administration 15 years earlier, and Johnson drew the line back even further as he said this about Medicare.
It'll improve a wide range of health and medical services for Americans of all ages. In 1935, when the man that both of us love so much, Franklin Delano Roosevelt, signed the Social Security Act, he said, and I quote him, "A cornerstone in a structure which is being built, but it is by no means complete."
Medicare and Medicaid were established as government single-payer programs, no private health insurance companies involved. But history did not end there. Millions of Americans continue to be uninsured and suffer the health consequences of that lack. Senator Ted Kennedy of Massachusetts made it a cornerstone of his 1980 presidential campaign. Here's a minute and a half of maybe his most famous health address at the party's midterm convention in 1978.
I had a father that was touched by stroke and sick for 7 years. We were able to get the very best in terms of health care, because we were able to afford it. It would have bankrupted any average family in this nation. Any average family that is represented in this hall this afternoon, and the millions of people that you represent all over this nation of ours. I had a son that was touched by cancer. Extraordinary health bills that we were able to afford, and we received the very best. It would have obliterated and wiped out the savings of any family, mortgaged their savings, and mortgaged the education of their children into the future. 7 months in the hospital I was with a broken back and received the very best of health care. I've been able to receive it for myself and for my family. Just like all of us who are on the tip of the iceberg, way up high in the health care services, we've got the very best, all of us at the tip of the iceberg. But I want every delegate at this convention to understand that as long as I'm a vote, and as long as I have a voice in the United States Senate, it's going to be for that democratic platform plank that provides decent quality of health care, north and south, east and west, for all Americans, as a matter of right and not of privilege.
Ted Kennedy in 1978. Jimmy Carter, president at the time, later put part of the blame on Kennedy for the failure of Carter's own health insurance reform plan as president. Kennedy died in 2009, a contributor to the Obamacare debate, but he didn't live quite long enough to see it become law. It's our 30 Issues election series, the history of the health insurance debate, public and private. And we continue with the history. Before Obamacare came the battle for Hillary Care. When Bill Clinton was elected president in 1992, he appointed the First Lady to head a health reform task force that would propose a law for universal coverage or something like it. President Clinton unveiled the proposal on September 22, 1993, as a product of bipartisan thinking.
The proposal that I describe tonight borrows many of the principles and ideas that have been embraced in plans introduced by both Republicans and Democrats in this Congress. For the first time in this century, leaders of both political parties have joined together around the principle of providing universal, comprehensive health care. It is a magic moment, and we must seize it. I want to say to all of you, I have been deeply moved by the spirit of this debate, by the openness of all people to new ideas and argument and information. The American people would be proud to know that earlier this week, when a healthcare university was held for members of Congress just to try to give everybody the same amount of information, over 320 Republicans and Democrats signed up and showed up for 2 days just to learn the basic facts of the complicated problem before us. Both sides are willing to say, we have listened to the people. We know the cost of going forward with this system is far greater than the cost of change. Both sides, I think, understand the literal ethical imperative of doing something about the system we have now.
President Bill Clinton in 1993, and nice try on the bipartisan thing, Bill, but Republican opposition turned out to be fierce. So is a series of attack ads on TV from the health insurance industry that featured a fictitious couple named Harry and Louise.
Well, I'm glad the president's doing something about health care reform.
He's right. We need it.
Some of these details.
Like a national limit on health care?
Really?
The government caps how much the country can spend on health care and says, that's it.
So, what if our health plan runs out of money?
There's got to be a better way.
There is a better way to reform. Call this toll-free number for the facts. Call today.
Hillary Clinton testified before Congress about her proposal, displaying mastery of health policy detail. Here's a minute of that testimony after she had come under heavy fire from a Republican questioner. It's September 28, 1993.
If you look at the Medicare system, you can see that in many communities that are relatively close together, like if you compare New Haven, Connecticut and Boston, Massachusetts, a Medicare recipient in New Haven costs the federal government about one half of what a Medicare recipient in Boston costs, with no discernible difference in the quality of care. There are so many examples in both our Medicare and Medicaid systems and in our private system which show, I think, conclusively that if we better organize how we deliver health care, if we are smarter about making the decisions that should be made, if we eliminate the unnecessary tests and procedures that too often drive up the cost, if we root out the waste and the fraud and the abuse, that is a very large amount of money that can be better allocated within the existing system.
Hillary Clinton, First Lady and policy wonk, impressive to many at the time, but not to Harry and Louise. This was their most well-known spot.
This was covered under our old plan.
Oh, yeah, that was a good one, wasn't it?
Things are changing. and not all for the better. The government may force us to pick from a few health care plans designed by government bureaucrats.
Having choices we don't like is no choice at all.
If they choose,
we lose.
For reforms that protect what we have, call toll-free. Know the facts. If we let the government choose, we lose. Call today.
Harry and Louise, a successful product of the insurance industry. The Clinton health reform failed in Congress. When President Obama was elected in 2008, he tried to learn from that failure by dealing the insurance industry in even more, with an idea that Hillary Clinton had run on that year and he had not, the individual mandate, the federal requirement that most Americans buy the health insurance company's product. That idea was anathema to the most progressive wing of the party, people like Ohio Congressman Dennis Kucinich and New York Congressman Anthony Weiner.
Let me begin by saying that we have tried with some success, but a great deal of confusion, to jerry-rig a health care system on top of the foundation of the private insurance model that if we were going to start from scratch, we would never choose. We'd never choose it because it's expensive. We'd never choose it because it's complicated. But we'd primarily never choose it because the insurance company's role in this is fundamentally contrary to what our role should be as members of Congress. They have an incentive, not because they're bad people, but because it's what they do, to take money in exchange for offering the service of health care. But they're not providing any health care.
Anthony Weiner on the floor of Congress on July 31st, 2009, at the peak of his prominence before his sexting scandal forced him to resign. Like LBJ in 1965, Obama reveled in the history of the struggle when he finally signed the Affordable Care Act into law the following year.
Today, after almost a century of trying, today, after over a year of debate, today, after all the votes have been tallied, health insurance reform becomes law in the United States of America.
Obama on March 23, 2010. But once again, it was not the end of health care history. And if progressives didn't like the individual mandate because it was a sweetheart deal for the private insurance industry as they saw it, they had strange bedfellows in the Tea Party who didn't like the mandate as government coercion, as at this Tea Party demonstration after the mandate was upheld as constitutional by the U.S. Supreme Court.
I woke up this morning, I was in a good mood, and I couldn't wait till they were going to, when they were going to release on the Supreme Court website the final decision of what they found with Obamacare, all right? And then I was one of those who, when they first reported it, I was one who said, all right, we won. And then about 2 minutes later, you realize, no, we didn't win. Obama won. The socialists won. The big government Democrats won. And the big government Republicans won. Right. We didn't win. The Tea Party didn't win today. But you know what it did? It energized us.
And so here we are in the 2016 presidential campaign. Republicans are running on repealing Obamacare and replacing it with something none of them have detailed. Bernie Sanders is running on replacing it with Medicare for all, starting over with universal government health insurance. Hillary Clinton finds herself saying that would be worse than what we get from the insurance companies.
If it's Medicare for all, then you no longer have the Affordable Care Act, because the Affordable Care Act, as you know very well, is based on the insurance system, based on exchanges, based on a subsidy system. The Children's Health Insurance Program, which I helped to create, which covers 8 million kids, is also a different kind of program. So if you're having Medicare for all, single payer, you need to level with people about what they will have at the end of the process you are proposing. And based on every analysis that I can find by people who are sympathetic to the goal, the numbers don't add up. And many people will actually be worse off than they are right now.
Clinton from the February 11th debate, and there is a very brief history of presidential campaigns and the health insurance debate. With me now to discuss some of what we just heard and some of the big things we didn't get to is Larry Levitt, co-executive director of the Program for the Study of Health Reform and Private Insurance at the Kaiser Family Foundation. He was a senior advisor in the 90s to the Clinton health reform effort. Mr. Levitt, thanks so much for doing this. Welcome to WNYC.
Thanks for having me.
And I guess I'll start with the Clinton health reform that you were involved with. Did you ever seriously consider proposing to abolish private insurance and replace it with a government single-payer system?
You know, it was a very long and complicated process with all kinds of options on the table. And, that was certainly one of many options looked at early on. But it was, I would say it was never seriously part of the discussions. As your history showed, the Clinton health effort, which was unsuccessful, ran into a buzzsaw of opposition. And that was for a fairly moderate plan compared to a national health insurance program.
So was it basically a political calculation by which single payer was not more seriously considered, just that you thought that would have run into a bigger buzzsaw?
It's interesting. I actually remember my early days in the administration and being the group of us being asked by IRA Magaziner to come up, not consider the politics, come up with the best, what we thought was the best plan. So surprisingly enough, politics didn't enter into the discussions as much as you might think. Still, there was really, a single payer plan just simply wasn't viable.
So if you weren't considering politics, those of you who are in the Clinton health plan design inner circle, what was it, just for the historical record, what was it that made you consider single payer not the best system from your group's point of view?
Well, I'll speak for myself. It's there are many advantages to a single payer or national health insurance plan. It is certainly simpler than what the Clinton health plan would have done or what Obamacare ultimately did. It's much more egalitarian in the sense that people are paying in based on taxes, so higher income people pay more and lower income people pay less, and it would certainly benefit lower income people while resulting in higher income people paying more. But it's very hard to get from point A to point B. It would be a very disruptive change. And if you look at the opposition that's developed in response to Obamacare, which in many ways was very modest, building on the current private insurance system, you can imagine the opposition that would have resulted if a single payer plan was trying to be put in place.
The Harry and Louise ads, do I remember correctly that they were from a certain sector of the insurance industry, not the whole industry?
That's right. I mean, the insurance industry back then, like in the run-up to Obamacare, was split. And there was a group of insurers that were, very, in some sense, mired in the past. I mean, these were insurers that were very aggressive in medical underwriting and excluding people who were sick, not creating new HMOs or managed care arrangements to try and get costs down. Mm-hmm. So it certainly was not the whole industry, but I think it's fair to say that there was a lot of opposition to that plan from insurers and others.
You said insurers who wanted to exclude people from their underwriting. Did you have in Hillary Care, if we want to call it that, the no denial of insurance based on pre-existing conditions, which has turned out to be one of the more popular aspects of Obamacare?
Oh, absolutely. Many of the elements of Obamacare had their origins in the Clinton health plan and plans before that, requiring insurers to take anyone regardless of their health, not charging sick people more than healthy people. Having insurers compete with each other. In the Clinton health plan, they were called alliances. Now they're called marketplaces. Very, very similar. The differences were that in the Clinton plan, there was an overlay of a more regulatory structure, setting a cap on how much insurers could increase their premiums. And that was one of the proposals that was a lightning rod.
What role did Ted Kennedy play? We played that 1978 Kennedy clip. And of course, he was such a giant in the movement for some kind of universal or expanded health care, if he played anything significant as a role in the Clinton health care policy or political battle. If I have my history right, President Carter thought, even as a universal health care advocate that Kennedy was, that Kennedy played a destructive role during the Carter years.
Well, I think, you know, the history you played was fascinating and terrific and touched on a lot of issues that, frankly, we still see in the debate today. I mean, if you look at the debate in the Democratic primary between Senator Sanders and Secretary Clinton, you know, between creating a Medicare for all single payer plan versus building on the Affordable Care Act. I mean, this debate goes way, way back among health reform advocates.
Because we remember Obamacare and Hillary Care and Medicare. We don't remember anything called Jimmy Care.
Or Nixon Care.
Yeah, well, the Republicans didn't. But Carter, did he make a serious effort?
Carter, I was quite young then, in junior high school. But
if you don't know, that's okay.
President Carter's emphasis was on cost containment. I mean, healthcare costs and inflation were rising dramatically at the time, so he was emphasizing cost containment, containing healthcare costs, and I think that's a lot of what engendered the opposition of Senator Kennedy, which was he wanted to see more emphasis on covering people. But, you know, there's been this long debate between do you go for what many reform advocates think is the perfect solution, a single payer plan, or do you accept something that builds on the current system or uses private insurers? And, you know, Obamacare passed because there was something of a detente between between the left and the center. And it was really that detente that paved the way for passage. I mean, still with no Republican support, but at least with full support among Democrats.
Well, if the Harry and Louise ads were a very effective thrust by the insurance industry to kill Clinton Care, do you see the individual mandate in Obamacare as in part a way to placate the insurance industry by requiring people to buy their product?
Well, I think a lot of the opposition to the individual mandate is misplaced. It's certainly a very controversial element of Obamacare, the most controversial element. But the goal was never really to placate the insurance industry in the sense that it was would give them more business. It's really a way to make the it's the spinach to the dessert in the plan. I mean, everyone wants people who are sick, people with pre-existing conditions, to get insurance. But if you guarantee insurance to people who are sick, you need some way to get healthy people into the insurance pool to balance that out. And the individual mandate is the way to do that. It's kind of the stick to get people to buy insurance so that you get healthy people into the pool as well. And there are very few ways to guarantee coverage to people who are sick without something like an individual mandate. Otherwise, you'll end up with premiums skyrocketing, as happened in New York, actually, many years ago.
Let's take a call from Peter on the Upper East Side, who I think wants to ask about another plank that was never adopted by the Democrats in these various health reforms. Peter, you're on WNYC. Thank you for calling.
Thanks, Brian. It's just a question. The idea of insurance being able to go across state lines. I know that's something Republicans talk about all the time, and it sounds like a good idea. And I know that the president talked about it as a point of possible compromise with Republicans back in 2009. But why didn't Democrats do it on their own if it is a good idea, or is there an opposition to it? What's wrong with it?
Yeah, I mean, it does sound like a good idea. And in fact, it happens all the time today. If you look at big insurance companies like Aetna, Anthem, and Cigna, and United Health, they all sell in multiple states. The issue is that they have to get licensed in those states by the state insurance commissioners in order to sell insurance. But for a big insurance company, getting a license is not that hard. The hard thing is creating a network of doctors and hospitals, and just saying that you can sell across state lines doesn't magically make those networks appear. I think some of the concerns about the plan is what happens with consumer protections. So, for example, if I live in New York and I buy insurance from a plan in Mississippi because Mississippi is a very friendly environment to insurers, let's say I have a problem with that insurance plan, who am I going to call? If I call the New York Insurance Department, they're not going to provide much help because I bought a plan in Mississippi. If I'm sitting in New York and I call the Mississippi Insurance Department, I'm not a constituent and I'm not likely to get a lot of help there. So it's a bit of a subterfuge in that it's a way to allow insurers to gravitate towards states that have more friendly regulatory environments. I'm kind of the same way you see credit card companies often, you know, ending up in Delaware.
It's our 30 Issues election series, health insurance, public and private. My guest is Larry Levitt, director of the Program for the Study of Health Reform and Private Insurance at the Kaiser Family Foundation. And Mark in Babylon, you're on WNYC. Hello.
Yeah, good morning. I did have a question. I noticed that in a lot of the news that I keep seeing, it's things like, you know, United Healthcare and various other insurers leaving the exchanges. And I just read something recently where it said, I believe, the average cost of care in Obamacare under the Affordable Care Act is roughly 22% higher than a private employer's plan. The question I would have is, and I saw that the forecasted costs could go to almost several trillion dollars a year in terms of what the government's been paying for Obamacare. Is Obamacare really sustainable at this point?
Yeah, there have been bumps in the road, no question. And it's really this challenge in getting healthy people to sign up. Once Obamacare began in 2014 and sick people could get insurance, they were first in line because they know they needed it. And it's been a challenge getting healthy people as well. The enrollment in these new health insurance marketplaces has been lower than expected and disproportionately sick. So that's meant higher premiums, some insurers losing money. I think premiums are likely to go up faster in the next couple years. I think it'll be more of a market correction than any sign that it's unsustainable. There are insurers like United Health, which is pulling out of the market. But that's honestly because it's a very competitive market. I mean, you know, when you have a competitive market, there will be winners and losers. United Health is one of the losers. Anthem said that it's actually roughly breaking even on its Obamacare plans and expects to earn a profit in the next couple of years. So there are insurers that are making it work and others that are struggling. So I think it's sustainable, but it's not quite fully stable yet.
I started our history tape crawl with Harry Truman, but we've talked mostly about more recent developments. I'm just curious if when he said in the State of the Union address in 1948, in the clip we played, that our ultimate aim must be a comprehensive insurance system to protect all our people equally against insecurity and in health, did he have a single-payer system in mind?
Absolutely. There have been a number of proposals for single-payer systems over time. And, you know, in many ways, people, you know, a strong constituency pushing for single-payer plans is what, those plans were never able to get majority support. So it, in some sense, splintered the health reform movement for decades until the Affordable Care Act passed. But it points to challenges we still have. I mean, the Affordable Care Act has covered 20 million people, but we still have 29 million people uninsured. So we're still well short of universal coverage of the kind that Harry Truman was looking for.
You know, one Tea Party critique of Obamacare, although the clip we played of a Tea Partier critiqued it as socialist. One Tea Party critique is that it weakens Medicare, which they support, by forcing cost controls on that health insurance for the elderly in favor of subsidizing the young to get to universal insurance. Do they have a point at all, in your opinion, about a transfer of health care resources, in effect, from older to younger in Obamacare?
Well, you know, it is certainly true that some of the financing for the Affordable Care Act came from reducing cost growth in Medicare. I wouldn't see that as a transfer of resources from seniors. I mean, most of that cost containment was things like reducing payments to hospitals, reducing payments to insurance companies that participate in Medicare. So it was, you know, it was, I think, healthcare providers feel the effect of that. I don't think patients themselves mostly feel the effect. So, you know, and it's, I mean, we talk about wanting to control healthcare costs, but it's a hard thing to do, and it's not always popular.
So last question. Are we a market-based outlier because of our anti-socialist values or the relative power of corporate money or anything else that you would say?
We're absolutely an outlier on healthcare. I mean, we spend more, we get less, and we cover fewer people than any other major industrialized country. You know, I think it is our fear of government involvement in healthcare. You know, which is a legitimate debate, but there are consequences to having less government involved. I mean, it means we pay much more for drugs, for example, than other countries do.
Larry Levitt, Senior Vice President of the Kaiser Family Foundation and Co-Executive Director of their Program for the Study of Health Reform and Private Insurance. Thanks for talking through some of the history and current issues with us. We really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Hope you've enjoyed all the political history this morning in our 30 Issues election special. And don't forget, you can sign up for our free 30 Issues newsletter. We'll send an email to you once a week during this series with all kinds of stuff, including thoughts from me and much more. Sign up for free at wnyc.org/30issues. We'll be back live on Monday, and we'll have a new issue, including a new audio history tour, every week until the election. Have a great weekend.